Great. Thank you, Steve. We could hear you loud and clear. It was great to have you join us. So now we will move on to a Q&A portion. Our speakers, would you like to move your chairs to the front, just if you'd like to face the audience? So we will alternate between the in-person audience and the online audience. Please remember to state your name and organization. And I would like to go ahead and give Suzanne Poland the chance to ask the first question.
Thank you, Julie. Thanks, Bob, Steve, and Jerry. That was very, very interesting. I think as you went through all of these presentations, a lot of you talked about the challenges and constraints to scaling technologies. And the webinar entitled Scaling Technologies, Bringing Research to Farmers. It sounds like we're looking at, you know, sort of massive multiplication of technologies or something, kind of a top-down, when we say it that way, bringing research to farmers and markets. And what it's really clear from what all of you said and what we really mean is scaling up adoption of technologies, getting the research into use. And I think all of you talked at different ways about smallholder farmers and everything, but I would just like to ask if each of you could maybe comment and elaborate a little further on what you see as the role of the smallholder farmer in this agriculture innovation system, and how understanding the farmer's role could improve the designs for scaling up technologies.
Maybe I'll go first since I had the first presentation. That's a good question on the role of the farmer in this endeavor. To go back to that example that I showed from Malawi of this doubled-up legume system, I think from the presentation you might have perceived that it was sort of top-down. Here's some scientists coming up with a system, sort of trying to get farmers to adopt it. But actually, more to Suzanne's point and Bob's point about this very intensive interaction with farmers from the very beginning, this doubled-up legume system that I illustrated is the result of about 15 years of work prior to Africa Rising, in which a range of systems were trialed and tested on farm with farmers, and many of those were eliminated. Maybe the labor requirements were too high. Maybe the outcomes were not enough to really interest farmers. The multiple benefits just weren't there for these other systems. So the system that I showed is the result of this very intensive prior experience with farmers in determining what would be viable for their situation. So without that, you could be chasing all these different technologies or systems that really in the practical experience of farmers just simply aren't worth it. So that's a long-winded way of saying get in there from the beginning with the farmers and really let them illustrate their needs and test these.
Yeah. Excuse me. I think I talked in various parts of my presentation about that, but of course that very qualitative interaction with the farmers from the beginning. Maybe the part that's important from our approach, when you take a commercial approach and when you're expecting farmers to buy things, and if you incorporate that from the beginning in terms of doing test marketing or prototyping with farmers, you're not distributing things. You're getting people to buy things. And therefore, that is a kind of substantive interaction with farmers, because when someone makes a decision to invest money, they have made that decision. Of course, before that, you have to find out what you have to have the substantive interaction to find out what it is that will make them purchase that. But that then going to that level then enforces that farmers are accepting this, or if they're rejecting it, then you have to find out why. And also it's about price. Farmers, you know, they vote with their pocketbook quite often.
do you have any comments you'd like to add?
I could, this is Steve, I'm not quite sure I understand the question exactly what the role is of smallholders, but I mean, like all farmers, I suppose their role is to produce increasingly better products at lower prices for a consumer society. But I think we should remember that these smallholder farmers aren't smallholders by choice. They're just people without much land and no water. So maybe, you know, if we're looking at research directed, and none of them want to stay smallholders, and no agricultural economy wants to remain dependent on smallholders. So, you know, we need a mixture of, and there is the problem for most smallholders, is their land size is just too small, certainly in East Africa, to ever get a reasonable living. So in the end, there has to be some change in this. But so we have to be careful when we're doing research and technologies, and to remember that it's really an interim situation. We hope.
I also wanted to highlight that we have 125 people joining from online from all over the world, including multiple African countries, England, Italy, Nepal, and Thailand. And we'll throw a question back to them right now.
Yes, so there were a number of questions about collaboration. Nome Sakane from Harvest Choice IFPRI in DC asked that, noticed that several players are currently involved in scaling up technologies. And since August 2012, Nome has been leading a project in Ghana, with different players are highly competing in northern Ghana to work with the communities. Every player claims their own community, and they may have different interests, which could lead to conflicts. How do we ensure that all players are well organized to work together in a more complementary way? And Liz Caselli asked a similar question, asking the panel to speak more about the structure of private sector partnerships in the target market, who takes what role, and who has long-term ownership of the technology.
To respond to the first question, I think that the critical piece is not competing about different technologies. The critical piece is your business model. What the conflicts that we come into with people is somebody is in the field and they're giving something away, or they're giving a three-quarter subsidy, and we're coming in and trying to sell things. And that so these things have to be worked out between organizations. You can't sell something if someone else is giving it away. And you can't build commercial systems if you're not selling something. And in all the examples, whether it's the pigeon pea, or whether it's pumps, or whether it's micro sprinklers, or all these things, ultimately they have to be sold to farmers. So I think, I don't have an answer to it, but we run into this all the time. And there are a lot of government programs that want to give things away. There's a lot of NGOs that are more on a relief model, I would say, rather than a development model, and they're asking farmers what their needs are and giving it away. So this is the major kind of conflict that we come into in the field. What was the second question?
Public-private partnerships.
I'm in favor. I'm not sure what the question is.
There no other comments? I'll throw it open to...
Yeah, can I make a comment? This is Steve.
Please do.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, just to go back to the question of how should the private sector be involved? Well, I think the private sector, we're in a private sector society. The whole point of development is for people to participate more and become wealthier. And in some ways, we should be talking about agriculture for wealth creation rather than food security all the time. But what I would say is that for good technologies to be scaled up quickly, you need, first of all, you need an end market. You've got, unless they can be applied in a particular environment where farmers can use the technology really, really quick to generate income quickly, they can't see a benefit. So there has to be a sort of triangular arrangement. You've got to have someone, you've got a product that you're going to grow and sell. Then there's an opportunity to scale up a technology. I'm trying to think of a good example. I think a good example that is old hat now really is like something, an old technology, which is evaporative cooling. So if you go around the areas of Kenya where farmers are growing vegetables to sell to the top supermarkets in Europe, these are guys with like half an acre of land, quarter of a hectare of land or less even. And they all have, and some of them quite, showing a lot of ingenuity, they've rigged up ways of creating small evaporative coolers around their fields using charcoal or brushwood and water, canvas, all kinds of stuff. And they've done it because if you plant French beans, 8 weeks later, you're getting paid as much as about, perhaps more than 60 cents a kilo for a crop that costs a fraction of that to grow. And you can do it three times a year. Their incentive to use, and of course these same farmers are also using, as soon as they're available, the best and safest agrochemicals. But they have a big incentive to do this because they're involved with companies that are on their doorstep sort of time, selling them these new technologies, these new products. And at the other end, they have got companies buying the product they're growing. So you really have to have that. If you have that, you're going to get scalability.
Thank you, Steve. We'll take a question from in person.
Sure. Hi, I'm Zachary Arney with ACDI Boca. I had a quick question for Steve. You had mentioned that buyers who buy from smallholder farmers typically have fewer risks, and I wasn't quite sure what risks you were referring to.
That's a good question. I'll be really quick. Put it this way: if you're growing a high-value product like a fruit or a vegetable in particular, but it can apply to other things, one of the worst things, for example, that can happen is you get a hailstorm, and these are quite common all across the East Africa, at least I think in many places around the world in our sort of latitude, and that wrecks your crop for 2 or 3 weeks or more. Because the skin is damaged, you have to throw 90% away. If you've got 500 groups of farmers producing these vegetables in scattered across a wide area, the chances of all of them getting hit by hailstones are minimal. In fact, maybe you might get 5 or 10% affected, but the rest is okay. You can still meet your supermarket order. If, on the other hand, you've got 100 hectares of baby carrots, carrots don't count, but beans or peas or something, in one plantation, then of course you're going to lose the whole crop. So in that sense, the risk is mitigated. And this happens all the time. The other thing, of course, is management of labor. It's much easier people working for smallholders, the labor and the smallholders don't walk off the job if something goes wrong. There are many ways, but the reason I raise this is because people usually think the opposite. People talk about the risks associated with smallholder production. But actually, if you really look at it objectively and don't make that sort of cliche assumption, the fact is there are many advantages, also profitable advantages, of buying from large numbers of growers. You just have to adapt your business model.
We'll take a question from online.
This question comes from Jared Gonsal from MIT. The speakers highlighted the importance of the value chain, supply chain, and private sector, and we often focus on product and technology innovation. But can the speakers highlight some process and or business model innovations?
Well, I think it depends what you call an innovation. Sorry, this is Steve again. The ones that really work, I think, are where companies are able to focus on products where they can buy this. Well, I mean, coffee, I guess, is a big advantage. You know, the coffee companies often do buy it, and the coffee traders do buy from smallholders. And they've adapted their business model just for that. But the best ones, I think, are where credit is also credit is also involved, whereby you have a triangular relationship. And again, I can, you know, since I'm here in Kenya, I got lots of examples in Kenya, but also it applies, I think, in other countries, whereby, you know, the company has an interest in procuring products from, and this can be mango, it can be French beans, we've mentioned, because they're big products, it can be maybe coffee, but they, or tea. But in the process of procurement, they then actually go into an arrangement with the bank so that the bank gets paid directly by the company. And this isn't necessary if you're buying products from a plantation, from a large-scale grower. But if you're buying from hundreds of growers or even thousands, then that kind of credit model is absolutely crucial. And there are quite a few of those around and they're increasing all the time. And I think because the banks have seen a long-term commercial advantage now in actually recruiting new clients through this kind of arrangement, everybody benefits. The banks, the processors, the farmers themselves, and their children, actually.
So, it's interesting that you picked that model, because as I was thinking, I came up with a similar model, something we were doing in northern Ghana, which involved small local banks, sellers of irrigation technologies, and farmers groups, and the business, and also installers. So there is the bank is loaning money to the group, and the group goes to the retailer, buys it with a kind of voucher, and then the retailer turns in the voucher to the bank and gets the money for that product. So that's a kind of another triangular relationship, which works quite well.
Hi, I'm Peter Boone from Corona Corporation. I have a question for Bob. When your project that you mentioned, working for the Gates Foundation, where you assessed different technologies that were best suitable for scale, and you, the electric pump was one of the ones, the diesel, I guess, powered pump. did you also look at mechanized, like, bicycle pumps? I've seen companies like Netafim from Israel, on a pilot basis, having just, you know, simpler mechanized pumps that, you know, don't use as much, they don't use diesel, they're lower costs, probably not as productive per hour, but more sustainable and easier to repair. Have you looked at those kind of alternatives at all?
Well, ID kind of made its name on those kind of pumps back in the 80s and 90s. So yes, of course, and it's still part of our product mix. But what happens over time, and it happened in South Asia, you know, there were 1 million or 2 million treadle pumps sold in South Asia. But if you go out now, you will see there's a tremendous amount of very cheap 3 and 4 horsepower diesel pumps out there, and people selling water to their neighbors and so forth. So as the price of motorized pumps come down, and in Africa where the price of human-powered pumps is not so cheap, they start to bump up against one another. And this, I think, we is something that we've encountered in Africa, where the price is close enough so that a lot of farmers will choose a motorized option. Yeah, it definitely returns to labor. Of course, then you have issues of fuel. We're working on some solar-powered options at this point, but that's still a little bit expensive. But actually, solar-powered options by the second or third year are going to be profitable, are going to be competitive, but the investment cost is higher. And again, we come back to, and especially in Africa, and everything's cheap in Asia, and everything's expensive in Africa. In Africa, finance, 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 and getting a good rural finance system is so critical. And then once you get, if you have a system like that, it opens up all kinds of possibilities.
A question from online?
Yes, there's a lot of conversation about the issue of gender in these technologies happening in the chat box right now, and they are concerned that the gender component has not been clearly stated or analyzed in this presentation. Britta Hansen of USAID BFS specifically asks, the question is, technology for who? Women are often left out of the conversation and implementation of new technologies, especially in terms of labor saving versus increasing women's time use.
Well,
can I answer? Sorry.
Go ahead, Steve.
Here's a quick one. Look, I think that most technologies favor, I mean, the most important technologies that we need right now, certainly in Africa, are labor-saving technologies. And these are going to benefit women. You know, there is a myth, of course, that somehow labor is cheap in Africa or labor is cheap in developing countries. Of course, it's not. It's not available. It's not that productive. Nobody wants to go out and farm in the hot sun and weed in the sun or apply difficult irrigation systems. So I think that labor-saving technologies and new technologies that enable smaller farmers to save on labor will benefit women relatively more than anybody else, since they do most of the work.
And I was just going to add that, of course, gender is a very important part of USAID's research efforts, and you know, there are many examples across our research portfolio that indicate that. But just talking about that example that I provided with the doubled up legume system, that's particularly of interest to women because of the nutritional value and the labor savings. You're harvesting more crops with fewer planting operations. The field preparation and planting is a major labor requirement, and it's often done by women. So to get more harvests with fewer plantings is a big boon, particularly for women. I think in the case of the pigeon pea, that might the benefits to women in particular may be a constraint. I think this needs more analysis. Maybe a constraint to increasing the availability of pigeon pea seed more widely. In other words, if it's not seen as a top tier crop for commercial production, it may limit its availability, thus limit its scalability. But we're looking more into that.
We'll take an in-person question. Let's see, I know you've had your hand up for a while.
Hi, Tim C. Xiao from the Office of Science and Technology at USAID. I have two questions. The first one is actually for Steve. You mentioned about the lesser risk of buying supply from small farmer. But I wonder, because small farmer also did not possess the scale of economy benefit compared to a large-scale farmer, do you imagine it would be more the sort of the supermarket channel managers would prefer actually mid-sized farmer and harvesting from different locations to mitigate the risk of the natural disaster, or do you think they will prefer to go to small farmers? Because imagine the number of small farmer will be a lot more, and that's a much higher transaction cost for a larger company to deal with that many vendors. That's my first question regarding the risk and whether they'll prefer a mid-sized farmer in different locations or a small farmer. And the second question is for IDE, actually, regarding the water management, because both of the activities that I've heard from this presentation are about increasing the exposure of water to a larger surface, and also to drag water from underneath the ground to the surface. And I imagine that in Africa, with in many places with higher evaporation rate, are we actually eating on the reserve for the water in Africa? Because those kind of issue has been observed in other part of the country, where when they tap into the underground water, actually it damaged the geological structure of the land for the long term. And imagine as the motorized pump gets cheaper and water usage demand will go higher. And I wonder, is there any other complementary technology that will help to preserve the water while boosting the productivity of the farmers? Thank you.
Thanks. Shall I answer first? I think that was the first question. Yeah, I think when it comes to who would the supermarkets rather buy from, I don't think they care really, as long as they're getting a product which is as cheap as it can be, and the quality is reliable. So it comes down to traceability. As far as the production is concerned, yeah, look, there are various reasons why small scale growers, certainly in horticulture, can be or ought to be just as productive. The two disadvantages for small scale growers are basically the cost of consolidation, aggregation. You know, I think that's what you're calling a transaction cost, and also quality variability and traceability. Actually, we've got some great technology coming out now that where we can trace product all the way back to even a small grower. Relatively cheaply. Again, this coming out from private sector companies who've got a long-term sort of strategic interest in being in the business. So even companies that are using IT and in their sort of day-to-day business are starting to develop these great IT systems for traceability of smallholder farmers. But as far as the supermarkets, I guess if the supermarkets have any preference at all from a market end, then they would like to project themselves as, you know, socially responsible organizations that don't stock their shelves, you know, with food full of preservatives and that kind of stuff. They buy from poor African farmers. So they probably would marginally prefer that.
Let me just also add to that before I answer the other question. That's why, he's sort of alluding to this, but the critical thing is aggregation. If you can get farmers to aggregate their produce, then it can be the same transaction cost buying from 100 farmers as it is buying from 5 farmers, if they're aggregating. To answer your other question, it's kind of a two-part question. One is about the sustainability of extracting water. Of course, it varies from place to place, but in this research project, they did quite an extensive study of the renewable water resource all over Africa, and they came out with quite high numbers of potentially renewable extraction of water. And quite often, you really have to break it down between shallow water and deep water. So the places where we've really gotten into trouble, like in Western India, they're extracting deep water, which is like water mining, okay? And that water is probably 10,000 years old, okay? And then once you extract it, it doesn't get replenished very easily. But shallow water, where you have a reasonable monsoon climate, is renewed every year. So you're basically you're drawing down a shallow aquifer that is renewed during the monsoon season. If you take northern Ghana, which if you go there now, if you went there a month ago, it would look like a desert. But they get about 800 millimeters of rain in 3 months, which is a tremendous amount of rain. It's as much as you have in Washington, I think, you know, or maybe a little bit west of here. The other thing is about technologies that can help you reduce the use of water. And IDE has been quite involved in introducing low-cost drip irrigation systems and sprinkler systems, micro-sprinkler systems, as FinTrack talked about. And that reduces the amount of water. The problem there is the cost. And also, you know, in places where water is quite cheap to extract, farmers don't have quite the incentive to save water. But especially like in our Burkina Faso program, our drip irrigation is quite moving along there. So those are the answers to the question.
We have time for one last online question.
Yes, there's a lot of them that we didn't get to, but this one comes from Vincent Johnson at Biodiversity International in Montpellier, France. The question is, Bob highlighted the need for funding support for M&E and post-project promotion, but many donors don't provide the longer-term funding necessary for this. How can we access support for longer-term work?
Maybe that's a question for you guys.
Yeah, Suzanne Poland just offered up the suggestion to align funding streams so that we're combining efforts on the technology side with other goals, and particularly aligning them with national government priorities so that it's not just the development community, but there's that element of program sustainability from the support side of the governments.
I wanted to pass the microphone over to Rob Bertram for some very quick closing comments, but right before I do that, ask if you wouldn't mind filling out the surveys that are on your chairs or in the chat box online. Those will help us this August help review our processes and improve things for next year. So, Rob?
Thank you very much, Julie, and good morning, everybody. It's wonderful to see a standing room only, and I guess if we had rafters, people would be hanging from the rafters. I want to start by thanking the newest team in the Agricultural Research and Policy Office. That's the Scaling Technology Team. It's headed by Andy Levin, and special thanks for today's program to Elizabeth Skugar, who I think worked with all of the speakers to put together what's been a tremendous program, and the discussion that it's prompted, I think, has shown how it resonated. I want to just make a few comments, starting with Jerry and his discussion. I think one of the messages, Jerry, that was inherent in your comments is this issue of biomass, and it cuts across our interest, whether we're interested in biodiversity, climate change, sustainable intensification of agriculture, and one of the other examples I think that didn't come up that the biomass is very related to is the integration of livestock. And there's another farmer in Malawi that we've talked about before named Rhoda, who has used the fertilizer trees, the nitrogen-fixing trees, to greatly increase the productivity of her land, which had been very degraded. And also, she's now, I don't know how many pigs she has now, but a lot more than she used to. And she's built a house. And they're really great stories. So the livestock piece of this is another thing. And then together with the legumes that Jerry discussed and the livestock, I think brings us back to the nutrition piece. And we have some initial data coming out of that work in Malawi that Sig Snap at Michigan State University has been involved in that shows that we're starting to see improvements in child nutrition in the households that are adopting these doubled-up legume systems. So some of that's an income effect, no doubt, but some of it may be a food effect in terms of direct consumption. So we're going to be studying that more, but it's an exciting time, and thank you, Jerry, for those great comments. Bob, I think you really did us all a treat by talking about water. This is, I think, a big piece of what is a much larger problem in African agriculture, and that is undercapitalization. And how do we get capitalization into the system? I know it came up towards the end of the discussion about hydrology, but I was glad you mentioned that also, because we've had some recent studies out of the UK and elsewhere that suggest that Africa has a very substantial potential to use groundwater sustainably. Speaking about motorized pumps, I was in Nigeria just last week. And there's a Chinese pump that's being used there by and promoted by one of our USAID partners that attaches to a small motorcycle. So if you can imagine a service provider who has a motorcycle who can go to his client farmers, many of them women, who can pump surface water or even in some cases maybe hand-dug wells because it'll pump 12 meters, uses a lot less fuel than a regular diesel pump. So not that there's anything wrong with diesel pumps, but it's a step, you know, in the right direction. And that we could envision that service provider providing smallholder farmers, as I said, many women of the women who can then have a part of their land in year-round horticultural production, for example, where there's going to be both income impacts and nutrition impacts. Just more broadly on that, I think that's part of a larger discussion on mechanization. And I think on the water side, this is an area that we are taking steps now. We're soon, Sahara Moon's team is going to soon be announcing a new small-scale irrigation program for sub-Saharan Africa. But I think the next thing on our agenda will be mechanization as we go forward, thinking about how to help smallholder farmers make this transition. On Steve, I think, did us a great service by talking about the whole issue of finance and the private sector linkages, as did Bob. But we're seeing some innovative approaches used by our missions where they're basically using outgrower schemes in staple crops to try to provide the inputs and the marketing opportunities, the aggregation that you mentioned, Bob. Also, Steve, you mentioned the interest in the legumes, which are higher value and, of course, higher nutrition. Great opportunity for the research community to bring in new technologies. The tissue culture banana, another, the reason they're so good is because they're not filled with viruses. It's clean material, so that gives you a big boost in your productivity. So again, the building these linkages where farmers come to think of, and all the partners think of, where can we get the best technology that's going to give us the productive outputs that we're looking for. Finally, or almost finally, a couple of really good issues came out, depth versus breadth, the impact and the targeting, and the impact metrics. I think we're going to be wrestling with those. What does scalability mean versus our traditional value chain approaches? Are we trying in some of this scalability to actually let go of things so that they ripple out? And how do we then measure that? So we're going to be working with people like Ann Swindale and others in the SPPM, our program office in the Bureau for Food Security, and with our M&E leads and our missions to really think through what's the best way to look at this. Is it by measuring the number of adopters? Is it by measuring the area of land that's being covered? Or do we need deeper information, as we often do have in our value chain projects? Also then, Steve raised the issue of smallholders. That's a really challenging one, and there were some comments in the discussion about this. You know, we in the Bureau for Food Security have taken a smallholder approach, and we know that large holders and medium holders are out there, but if we're going to achieve our poverty reduction and our nutrition impacts, it's very hard to see how that can happen absent a smallholder approach. And I also want to remind people that smallholders are still very active in Asia, in areas where smallholder farmers are no longer poor. There's still a lot of smallholders. So, you know, Africa's going to be its own case, but there's a lot of South-South learning. You talked about the water. That's a great example of South-South learning. But I think we can learn through this transition that we're all seeking, where people go from poverty and undernutrition to a much better life. And can we do that in a smallholder way? The issue of finance, critical. We're going to do our best to put all this together and make that happen. So in sum, a lot of what we're doing in our R&D programs is about risk reduction to try to potentiate this transition for smallholders. And I think part of that is that it's risk reduction in staples that's going to help us diversify. In other words, people in Malawi are not going to stop growing maize unless they're sure they can either grow enough maize or buy enough maize in order to shift to higher value crops. So this, we're not looking at either or, it's both. It's legumes, it's livestock, it's horticulture, it's also maize, wheat, rice, sorghum, and the others. Water is a huge thing for us. I mentioned we'll soon have a new program. We have Dr. Binyam Ayub, who's just joined our staff to lead that effort. Mechanization, I said, we'll have a new push there. And then finally, I think the other take-home message from all of this is that we need to figure out how to link our partners, the CGIAR, the innovation labs in the U.S. universities, our private sector partners in R&D, with the missions and their partners that are doing the value chains. And we need to not think of a dichotomy between value chains and technology, because technology to work has got to be in a value context. So working with our mission partners and their partners, as we just did, Sahara Moon was at her group convened a meeting in Ghana just last week between these kinds of partners, and there's great potential there. So we're very excited about this, and thanks to all the speakers and to all of you who participated for making this such a rich discussion.
We'll send out the post-event resources next week. Thank you.